Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for your regular host, Frank Gaffney, who is traveling around keeping the world safe for democracy. We're joined with another member of our team, Kyle Scheidler, who is the director of our Threat Information Office. And Kyle, we definitely need some information on a particular threat right now. I'm talking about the Kurds. The Kurds are our only ally in the entire messed up Iraq, Syria, ISIS region. And for some reason, it appears that President Obama has made a deal with Turkey, or something has happened that has given the Turks the idea that bombing the Kurds, who are a problem for them, might be okay. Can you shed a little light what's going on over there?
Well, Jim, it started off with a bombing that took place outside a Kurdish medical nonprofit group inside Turkey, just across the border from Syria, and about 30 to 40 people were killed, and many more were injured. And this was the motivation that Turkey claimed to use to move in against the Islamic State, and there were cheers in the Western media, and everyone was excited because Turkey has finally gotten on the bandwagon with going against Islamic State. Unfortunately, it appears that the reality is that Turkey is using this opportunity to spend its ordnance not so much against Islamic State as against the Kurds. We've seen that they've launched multiple airstrikes against PKK positions in Iraq. They've shelled YPG positions, Kurdish positions in Syria, I should say. The goal now, according to the New York Times and the Washington Post, is that there will be a deal between the United States and Turkey, which will permit Turkey to establish a safe zone about 68 miles long on the Syrian side of the border. And this is interesting.
Safe for who?
This is something safe for who? Right. Well, so supposedly for Syrian refugees and Syrian rebel groups that the Turks and the U.S. have been supporting. But what the Turks are really interested in, it appears to me, is to keep the Kurds, who have been very successful in pushing back against Islamic State, from expanding into this area and connecting Kurdish sections in the east with Kurdish sections in the west. So they're really trying to preempt the Kurds more so than take the fight to Islamic State.
So, all right, now, Turkey's been a problem for a long time. They're a NATO member, so we have a pretty tight relationship with them. But since their Prime Minister Erdogan has been increasingly Islamifying the country, even though he might have suffered a setback in the recent election, the country overall has moved far closer to the Islamists than to NATO. It seems to me that having them as an ally is kind of a mixed blessing. They made a deal with us apparently to allow us now to use Incirlik Air Base in Turkey to base some of our operations against IS in Iraq and Syria from. Now, that's a big concession that makes our air operations considerably more effective because it's much closer to the fight than where we've been basing from. But did we really throw the Kurds under the bus to get Turkey into the fight against ISIS and to get basing rights for Incirlik? Is that what happened?
That's exactly what happened. This is something that the Turks had requested some time ago. When we initially made our request for Incirlik Air Base, the Turks came back and said, well, we want a no-fly zone, safe zone across the border in Syria, and we were reluctant to do that for the very reasons that we've mentioned, because it alienates the only effective ground force we've really had in Syria against Islamic State, being the Kurds. So apparently we have now walked back that. We've essentially folded to the Turks and are going to give them that concession in exchange for getting the airbase.
And so our only actual ally, the only people who had even the slightest bit of love for us in that entire region, we're now throwing under the bus for another group of Islamists who don't like us. We should be arming the Kurds and empowering the Kurds to take the fight to IS. They've been the most effective against the Islamic State. They've been a friend for a long time. And now Obama has chosen, as is his wont, to cozy up to another group that has our worst interests at heart. Is there anything that, I guess, other than pressure, is there any good news around this potential addition of Turkey to the losing side in the battle against IS? I mean, are they going to, other than a safe zone, are they going to roll tanks into Syria and Iraq and potentially help push ISIS back? Or are they just, as you said, trying to make sure that the Kurds' effectiveness doesn't gain any more territory for them?
Well, what I expect is that, having established this buffer zone, I don't think they're going to go any further. The Turkish military was not particularly excited about having to do this anyway. They were kind of hoping to stay out of it. But Erdogan wanted it, and now it appears that they're going to get it. So they'll use this buffer zone, in all likelihood, to support the Syrian rebels that they most favor. The problem with that is it's the exact kind of guys that we here in the U.S. have been trying to stay away from, which is to say the Turks have been caught trying to arm al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda-linked groups. The Syrian rebels that are most jihadist, that are most against the West, those are the ones that Turkey likes. We can expect that those are the ones that they'll be aiding as they establish this safe zone for Syrian rebels then to take the fight to Assad. Remember that Turkey's primary interest is defeating Assad. It's not defeating the Islamic State. They've been credibly accused of really being, at a minimum, neutral and probably even helpful to the Islamic State, permitting the movement of fighters, permitting people to Islamic State fighters to use Turkish hospitals. There's a report even of a secret hospital where Islamic State fighters are able to go and get treated and then come back into the fight. So this is the ally, the NATO ally, that we've been working with and is now targeting the very group that our Pentagon said was the most effective fighting force in Syria.
Well, all right, so we got a presidential election coming up. We've got at least a chance to elect a commander-in-chief who may not be on, if not the other team, at least aligned with the wrong people. I'm a big fan of Kurdistan. Kurdistan would be a huge problem for Turkey, and consequently, I mean, it is the reason that they're doing what they're doing now. They're trying to make sure that the Kurdish parts of Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Iran don't become one state. Is this in a new commander-in-chief's plan? Would that be a helpful thing to have, a Kurdistan where we might have an actual ally in the fight against all these people who definitely are not our friends?
Well, you know, Jim, I think part of the problem we've had so far is that everyone in the region has a view of what they want a future Iraq and Syria to look like, and they have some proxy or some force that they're using to make that happen. The Iranians have the Shiite militias. The Turks have been backing al-Nusra and some of the other jihadist forces in Syria. And the one force that we could use, the one force that has begged us to work with them, has been the Kurds in both Syria and Iraq, and yet we have been extremely reluctant to do that. We have insisted on providing military aid and support to the Baghdad government, which is then supposed to transfer aid to the Kurds, but of course they don't. And we have, as we've just seen, taken the side of the Turks against the Kurds on the Syrian side of the border. So we're the only one who don't have a dog in this fight, and That's a serious error, because everyone can see that we don't have a future outcome that we prefer.
Well, Kyle, what can we do? I mean, is there a recommendation vis-a-vis Turkey or the Kurds that you would have for this administration or the next one?
Well, I think it's going to have to be for the next administration, because I don't see much help with this current administration. They're very comfortable with the idea of a Iraq dominated by Iran and Syria dominated by I'm not sure what.
And, chaos.
You know, by chaos. And this is a region where, you know, we talked about friends and allies, and this is a region where they respect you if you back your ally. Even if they don't like them, they respect it. You know, I've heard people say from the region, you know, we see how the Obama administration is treating Israel. How can we, you know, the Arabs in the Gulf, expect to get any kind of backing, you know, against Iran? And it's the same thing here, where everybody knows that the Kurds are our natural allies, and they see how we treat them, and they know that we're not to be trusted. So even if they don't like the Kurds, even if they're opposed to the Kurds, as Turkey is, if we had stood up and said, look, these are our boys in the region and we're going to back them, that would be respected, even if, you know, it wasn't appreciated. But we've chosen not to do that.
Unfortunately, Obama has made nothing but bad choices since he decided to cut and run from Iraq and started this whole mess, losing the peace after we won the war. Folks, we've been talking with Kyle Scheidler, director of the Threat Information Office at our own Center for Security Policy. Thanks, Kyle. And next up, we'll be talking with John Sitalides, who is a principal with Trilogy Advisors, and he will be telling us about the mess in Greece.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined this segment by John Sitalides, who is a principal with Trilogy Advisors and an advisor to the State Department. John, I wanted to talk with you a bit about what's going on with Greece. It has been festering for a while, kind of simmering to a boil, and I don't know that people are really sure what's going to come of it. It sounds like they may have come to an agreement to bail them out, but I think there's an awful lot of smoke and mirrors going on, and we're hoping you could shed a little light on that. So what's the current state of play with Greece and the rest of the EU?
Well, first, thank you for having me, Jim. Let me just state that where we are right now remains, unfortunately, for Greece, for the Eurozone, and for all observers around the world of what's been happening in the last 6-7 months, remains in a state of flux. The Greek government has taken a 180-degree turn from a very, very poorly negotiated bailout process in the first 6 months of 2015, and we delivered one of the harshest reality checks in modern history in July of 2015 that's simply wasting everyone's time trying to achieve unattainable goals was the worst thing the Greeks could have done for themselves. It has now cost them $60 billion in additional economic damage that has to be absorbed into a third bailout package, the negotiations of which still have not been agreed to. And what we saw the last several weeks was a series of votes in the Greek parliament insisted upon by the Eurozone, the group of European finance ministers overseeing Greece's bailout terms, stating that first there must be preconditions to launching negotiations on whether the Eurozone and the Troika, that is the European Central Bank along with the IMF, would even offer Greece another bailout round. So that process is scheduled to start this week. It could take anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. There's no guarantee it'll have a positive outcome, although most observers believe that at this point, with the very difficult additional reforms the Greek parliament has voted in, that that will in fact take place. And so Greece will secure an additional about 86 billion euro or $95 billion on top of a $250 billion debt that already burdens its economic fortunes going forward. There's just one last glitch, Jim. The IMF, which has been asked to participate in this, has declared that it cannot do so unless there is some type of sustainable debt relief in sight for Greece over the long term. And that's something that Germany and other northern European powers do not want to give to Greece yet until they see that the Greeks are serious about not only enacting but implementing reforms. So the IMF role may not be clear for yet another 6 months or so.
We're talking with John Sitalides. John is an advisor to the State Department as well as a principal with Trilogy Advisors. And he just laid out for us a pretty scary prospect for the recovery of Greece and their overall financial prospects. Now, John, you mentioned that this is all contingent on Greece and the Eurozone and the banking folks who are part of that coming to an agreement that has some sort of long-term prospect for success. Given that this has just been kind of the putting a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound for a while, what reason is there to believe that the Greek economy or the entire system where they seem to be spending like us, but in a greater way, considerably more than they're taking in, likely to change? Is there a reason to believe that this is other than kicking the can down the road?
This has been a problem that has been festering and growing in the Greek economy for approximately 40 years. And it all really came to a head with the global financial crisis, exposing Greece's inability to repay the massive debts that it had accumulated over the decades, and especially in the last 10 to 12 years. The problem, Jim, I think in many ways is a strategic one for Greece. It really does not have a productive economy. It exports very little of great value into global markets. It's in many ways a closed economy, very non-competitive in many ways. You have overwhelmingly powerful trade unions that have opposed any serious reform over the decades, many nationalized industries, and just barriers to business freedom, to foreign direct investment that are really out of the norm with most Western freer economies. And so what Greece really needs is economic freedom. And it's been very, very difficult to get the Greek body politic and the political leadership to move the country in that direction. In many ways, this is the worst medicine for Greece and the best medicine at the same time, because without this crisis, it really would not have been imaginable for Greece to ever undertake the kinds of reforms that the Eurozone is now imposing on Greece in exchange for additional financial assistance. Greece should remain in the Eurozone or whether it should plan to revert to the drachma, which was the currency until 2001. And many of the people who know these economic issues far better than I do will posit that what's less important is the currency and what's more important is reform. Without reform, it doesn't matter what currency the Greeks use. But reform is now a great possibility, and if they enact these reforms and implement them, you could see a tremendous Greek economic revival in 5 to 7 years.
So now let me ask you a question. Does Greece represent the far end of the social democracy project that I often hear, you know, progressives in the United States saying we need to be more like Europe. We need to have better benefits. We need to have better wages and pensions. And yet, you know, that seems to be what a large part of the problem has been for Greece. Those things have outstripped the productivity, and consequently, they're upside down on what they're producing versus what they're consuming and giving away internally. So are they an outlier in the EU, or are they a harbinger of what happens when, as Margaret Thatcher said, you know, socialism's great until you run out of other people's money?
In some ways, Jim, both of those apply to Greece. You know, Europe is far more social democratic, if not outright socialist, depending on which country we're talking about, than we would believe might be the case anytime soon in mainstream American politics. The problem with Greece, and for that matter, other countries such as Italy, lesser so in Spain and Portugal and France, is that you have a greater recklessness in terms of the way socialism is the engine of political economy in these countries. Italy, Spain, and France at least have very productive economies, and they're able to sustain the socialist model in ways that Greece has simply been unable to. Because Greece does not have a very productive economy, it is dependent almost exclusively on European Union subsidies and on cheap credit since the drachma was removed, replaced by the euro, and then Greeks were able to get 2 and 3% interest rates as if they were based on the Deutschmark. But what you have also in Greece, Jim, is unbridled corruption. And that has really eaten away at the fabric of the economy in Greece. Nothing really gets done in Greece in any significant manner without bribery, without payoffs, without having inside connections in government. And this is what has held back a Greek society that, as many people here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, Greeks are some of the hardest working, most productive, and eventually most successful immigrant groups in any country. That's built into their DNA when they operate in an environment that lets them thrive, such as that we at least have had here in the United States to date, but that has been denied them in Greece, and it's why the country has remained relatively poor, unfortunately very corrupt, and highly unproductive and non-competitive in ways that are destroying the middle class of what used to be an affluent, modern, developed European Union state.
Hopefully this will, as you said, become a wake-up call for Greece, and they can make the hard decisions they need to and return to the productivity its citizens can make, even if its system has failed to. Folks, we've been talking with John Sitalides, who is a principal with Trilogy Advisors, as well as an advisor to the U.S. State Department. Up next, we'll be talking with Joseph Schrodel, a retired brigadier general who served in the United States Army Corps of Engineers and currently executive director of the Society of American Military Engineers.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin rendered incalculably important public service twice. First, the Senate Homeland Security Committee chairman conducted a hearing about the vulnerability of the U.S. electric grid to attack from Iran or other enemies, or even naturally occurring solar storms. The hearing established that the danger is real and could destroy our country. It made the case powerfully for the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, recently approved by the House counterpart to Senator Johnson's committee. Armed with this evidence, Senator Johnson then asked Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz about these threats to our electric grid. Moniz, who was testifying on behalf of the flawed Obama bomb deal with Iran that he helped negotiate, seemed blasé about them. Fortunately, Senator Johnson isn't. Let's pray his leadership will help end this vulnerability. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I'm Peyton Manning. On the football field, I always had to prepare for the unexpected. My teammates and I train to think fast and be ready ahead of the game. You can be ready with the help of your local American Red Cross. The American Red Cross can help all of us prepare for life's emergencies. Take life-saving CPR or first aid courses. Make an emergency plan or learn how to build a disaster supplies kit. Contact the American Red Cross today.
Call 1-800-HELP-NOW or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney. And this segment, we're joined with General Joseph Schrodel, a retired brigadier general who served in United States Army Corps of Engineers and currently executive director of the Society of American Military Engineers. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Appreciate the time.
Well, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about some of the dangers to our critical infrastructure and the role military engineering can play in making them a little safer. We have a lot of vulnerabilities, and I think one of the areas that is particularly at risk is our electric grid. And I wondered if you could give us just kind of a primer on how the U.S. military looks at vulnerabilities to its power supplies and what they've done to mitigate that.
The first point that I would make, I think it's interesting to note the executive order that came out related to climate change, that they kind of focused on four steps that we need to prepare. We need to then absorb whatever happens. And I think that's not just Mother Nature, but man-made. Then we need to recover. Then we need to adapt. So if you take those four steps that were laid out in that executive order, I think you'll find that our military engineering organizations, the Corps of Engineers, NAVFAC, the Air Force Engineers, Public Health Service, Coast Guard, are all as a part of this government and as part of securing our national security, not just defense, you know, are all focused on that. And it adds up to one word, resilience. How do we ensure, and this is the foremost concern about the military to get to your question, how do we ensure that we, the military, can perform their mission regardless if something happens? So let's talk about energy for a second. So if the grid goes down, how can the military ensure that, in fact, they can perform their mission if the grid's down, prepare to deploy whatever they need to do on an installation? So a lot of the energy discussions in the military focus on ensuring that there is reliable power on military installations. So in the past, It's been things like generators, which take a lot of fuel, which take a lot of other resources to keep them going, so still vulnerable. Second option, how about renewable energy? I would tell you a lot of the services are finding that renewable energy options are expensive and maybe don't break even, so you've got cost considerations. Kind of tough in a post-war environment that we're finding ourselves sort of in now, where in fact, you know, the resources aren't there to pay those extra things. So microgrids become a way. Matter of fact, the first microgrid that was put in place in Silver Spring, Maryland was actually done by one of our members. And it was the installation at the FDA headquarters in Silver Spring. It includes several turbine generators capable of producing 21 megawatts of power. On the West Coast, the Port of Los Angeles is a good example, where they're instituting an energy management action plan that includes things like rooftop solar, some other emergency power generation, small-scale microgrid pilot projects for contingency operations. So in essence, what the military is concerned about is ensuring that there's reliable power on installations so they can complete their missions if they're asked to do something when the greater grid may be out for whatever reason. So back to my point about resilience, it's preparing by doing some of those kinds of things, being able to absorb whatever Mother Nature throws at you, which means keep going, and then recover to reestablish the major grid connection, and then learn from that and look forward and adapt for how do we keep things moving forward. So let me stop there and see if that might prompt some thought.
One of the things that has been discussed, at least recently during the discussions about the Iranian nuclear deal, is a document that showed that the Iranians actually had plans to attempt to take down our grid using an EMP. Folks, you know, who don't know, that's an electromagnetic pulse. It's created when a nuclear weapon is detonated high in the atmosphere. Is there any hardening or any other things that can be done?
Regardless of the threat. You know, whether it's an EMP threat, whether it's hackers, whether it's whatever, you know, I would tell you the first point is the other thing that the services are doing, I think, well, is focusing on managing risk. And I would tell you one of the things that we all ought to be aware of is the whole, and a piece that we're looking at is the cybersecurity aspect of this. If you were to ask the average American which sector is attacked most, banks, the banking sector, or the energy sector? Most, and I do this, and a lot of most people I ask that question to say, oh, banking for sure. Now, I'm telling you, that's not the case by a factor of probably 50-fold or better. Every day, our electric grid is the foremost attacked system through cyber means in the entire United States. So I would tell you, whether it's an EMP attack, a cyber attack, whatever kind of attack, energy is something we should all be concerned about because it is the most attacked sector in our infrastructure by a long shot.
Now, that was something the DIA director mentioned that in testimony. He mentioned that there were at least three major powers, you know, and he named the Chinese and Russians, and the implication, and at least the folks I've talked to, said that Iran was the third that he was talking about. Regularly and for a number of years have been probing and kind of wandering around in our electrical and power systems because at this point, like every other industry, the electric industry has networked all of their systems. And unfortunately, it doesn't appear that the security currently is up to snuff to keep them out. Now, if they're in there now, do you think it's that they just haven't determined it's a good idea to try and take it down? Or have we maybe succeeded in some way at trying to keep them out of those systems?
Well, I frankly think that proof is in the pudding. I think the results speak for themselves. The fact that banking systems haven't collapsed, the fact that our grid hasn't been taken down, I think speaks volumes for the work that's going on behind the scenes to protect the infrastructure of our society. And then on the other side, back to this resilience piece, the work that is going on behind the scenes between levels of government, federal, state, local, between agencies, the interagency cooperation piece. From what I see, I would tell you there is a heck of a lot of work that people don't see, but you got to look at the results. I'm an outcomes kind of person. And if the grid hasn't been taken down, guarantee you, they can't. and they haven't been able to, and we've been able to thwart it. You can say the same about terrorist attacks in this country. It's well documented that, you know, we have defeated scores of potential attacks inside this country. So my hat's off to all of those folks at every level of government that are doing that, and it's an honor for us in the case of the military to serve our military constituents in helping to bring private sector solutions together with the public sector, and that's really what we do. We bring the best that's out there in the private sector together with the government, local, state, federal level to solve problems and to help mitigate risk. So my answer to your question, in short, would be I frankly believe that, you know, when I get up in the morning and turn the power on, there are a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of good, and the bad guys are failing. And that's good for us.
Absolutely. We're talking with Joe Schrodel, who is the executive director of the Society of American Military Engineers. He's been giving us some insight as to the work being done to make sure that when we get up in the morning, the power goes on. Joe, do you think there are additional steps we could take? You know, are there things we should be doing right now that we could use additional resources for?
I frankly think that one of my main concerns is that we educate the American public, and that the American public knows what's going on, and that they realize they're a part of this. If you take a look at, you know, this year is the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and Rita, and we just happen to be sponsoring our annual small business conference in New Orleans this year, where we will celebrate the great work in recovering that occurred 10 years ago. But I would tell you, it's also time that every American understand what the vulnerabilities are, understand how to respond. If you remember President Bush after 9/11, the first thing he said was get back to work. You can't just stop and wait for somebody to fix things. You got to take the action in your own hands. I think we need to do a lot of work in terms of personal responsibility, educating people to know what's going on. So when something does happen, a big part of resilience is our resolve that we are going to pick ourselves up and continue. When we fail to be able to do that, that's when we have to start worrying. So I think on the education side and making sure people really understand what's going on so they can help, they can respond to ensure that we are resilient, and thereby we will secure this nation forever.
Well, we appreciate your assistance in helping to educate our audience on this very topic. We've been talking with Joe Schrodel, who is Executive Director of the Society of American Military Engineers. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Gordon Chang, columnist for Forbes.com, about bad news for the Chinese economy and the role North Korea is playing in the Iran nuclear deal.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney. And we're joined this segment by Gordon Chang. Gordon is a columnist for Forbes.com and also writes for the World Affairs Journal and is an expert on all things Pacific Rim. Speaking of that, Gordon, you wrote a piece recently discussing how the Chinese seem to have an issue, a large issue, with the amount of gold reserves they have on hand or are reporting on hand, somewhere in the vicinity of potentially a couple thousand ton discrepancy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
On the 17th of this month, the People's Bank of China, which is the central bank, revealed the country's official gold reserves. And they announced that they were holding 53.32 million troy ounces of gold. Now, that sounds like a lot. And indeed, it's up 57% from the last time they announced a change, which was April 2009. But most analysts thought they were holding much more. Many analysts thought that China was holding twice or three times the amount that they admit to. This is interesting because one way to look at this is that there's 1,850 tons of missing gold. And the question is, Where is it? Did the Chinese actually tell us the truth about their gold holdings? Or maybe perhaps they didn't buy as much as people thought. So there is going to be a lot of analysis, because I think this actually shows some very important trends in the Chinese economy. One of them being is that the Chinese central government is not in as good a position as many people assume it to be.
But the Chinese have bigger problems with their stock market overall. Tell us a little bit about the trouble they've got there, and how a lot of the folks who were talking about the Chinese being the next great power may have overestimated a bit.
Yes, on Monday, the Shanghai Composite Index, which is the most widely followed of the Chinese indices, dropped 8.5%. This is after Beijing had mounted a rescue. To put this in a little bit of perspective, going back to about a year ago, the Chinese stock market started this bull run, largely and maybe only because the Chinese central government thought that it was a good time for the Chinese people to buy stocks. So this was a dangerous, this is a reckless policy. The market came off of its recent highs on June 12th. There was a big, sickening fall. The Chinese government mounted a rescue, which looked like it worked. But Monday is the second straight day of stocks falling. The reason why this is important is because it shows a couple things. First of all, the Chinese government is really out of policy options, and that essentially the Chinese market and economy really wants to settle in at a much lower level. This means that China is at risk because its political system is dependent on continually delivering prosperity. And right now, China is in severe trouble with its economy. And the question is, what will it do? Will it lash out, which is a real possibility?
Now, they've done a lot in other areas. As you mentioned, they obviously are the big dog in the Pacific Rim, since we have decided to lead minus our pivot, but we're leading a lot more from behind. But they have a lot of mineral activity and oil activity in Africa. They seem to have been traveling around the world, buying up a lot of the precious metals, the heavy metals, the things that are required for industry. Is that where you see their ability to destabilize things, or do you think it might be military-based?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of China's purchase of minerals and oil, what they have done is they've never trusted the spot market, so they have overpaid for commodities, and now they can't use all the commodities they have committed to buy. So in one way, you know, China, regardless of what goes on in the South China Sea or elsewhere, you know, is going to have to dump commodities on global markets. That's not going to make a lot of people around the world happy, especially the Australians and the Brazilians who have sold them and want to sell them iron ore and other minerals. That's the least of the problems, though, we have with China. What I'm worried about is China going on an aggressive, provocative path. We see this with the incursions in Indian-controlled territory, and we also see it all the way in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. So there's an arc of problems that China is causing all around its southern to eastern peripheries. This is where perhaps history's next great conflict starts. And that's the thing I'm worried about. Commodities is the least of my concern at this particular time, although they will roil commodity markets, as they have already.
Unfortunately, you add to the list of places where the next great conflict could happen. Do you think there's a chance that North Korea could be a provider? I mean, people talk about Pakistan, and obviously they have proliferated before. But there's been a lot of talk about North Korea having worked with the Iranians on their program. Do you think there may be a transfer either in play or already occurring anywhere else in the region?
Well, the Iranians and the North Koreans have had a joint nuclear weapons development program for more than 15 years. You know, and this is highlighted by in October 2012, the Iranians from the Ministry of National Defense actually put weapons and technical specialists into a military base in North Korea, 53 miles south of the Chinese border. North Koreans have been selling technology and even semi-processed fissile material to the Iranians. So this is an ongoing problem. And with this arrangement, this framework agreement with Iran, if it indeed goes forward, they will have more money from which they can purchase all sorts of stuff, including missiles and chemical weapons and the like from the North Koreans. They already have done this in the past, so this just gives them more cash to spend on their North Korean friends.
Is there any chance? Now, obviously, that might ameliorate some of the problems North Korea has. If they're selling, you know, all these things, if the embargo is released, you can't buy from North Korea, though. They're still prohibited from exporting, so it still have to be under the table if the Iranians use them as a supplier. Is there any chance, though, they might go the other way and also supply the Gulf Arabs, or is that kind of a non-issue due to their partnership with Iran?
Well, the North Koreans will sell anything to anybody, and so they would love to sell to the Gulf Arabs, but I don't think that they will. The one big story here is that this administration, and especially the one before it, did not stop the North Koreans from selling the most dangerous technologies and materials around the world. This is bipartisan failure. And although I think we need to criticize the Obama administration for a lack of dealing with North Korea, you have to look at even worse policies in the Bush administration. The American people need to demand better from both political parties, because when we look back, perhaps the biggest failing of this and the previous administration will be their failure to stop the proliferation of the most dangerous technologies and materials from North Korea with China's assistance, and we did nothing about it. The American people should be outraged.
And now, given that we had the same kind of deal with North Korea as we're currently putting into place with Iran, and it didn't stop them and still hasn't stopped them, do you think then that the Iran deal may be a follow-on, just another failed attempt to put a good face on a bad situation?
The problem so much with the United States is not that we strike deals with Iran or North Korea, is we don't enforce them. And we say we put these deals in place and we say, oh, problem solved, let's go on to the next issue. And so there's a lot to dislike about the Iran deal, but what is really bad about it is that there is really a lack of ability to inspect Iranian sites. Got to remember that it's not only just the sites in Iran itself, it's that Iran has got people in North Korea, and we're not going to be inspecting those people pursuant to this deal. No one's even talking about it. The administration does not want to talk about this issue of the partnership between Iran and North Korea and the assistance that China is giving both of those countries. This is a scandal. I mean, this is enough. It's by itself to sink the Iran deal, and we're not doing enough to publicize these issues because they are critical to our security.
Gordon Chang, who is a columnist for Forbes.com and writes for the World Affairs Journal. Thank you, Gordon, for your insights. Folks, that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank will be back tomorrow. He will inform you and keep you educated on the issues that are troubling us today.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.